Hey guys, and welcome back to Season 4 of Classic Camera Revival. That's right, you just can't get rid of us. However, outside, it is really cold out here. We're in the middle of a cold snap here in southern Ontario. And so today we are talking about the cameras that we take out when it's minus 20.
Coming to you live from Toronto, Canada, this is the Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to our show.
All right, and before we even begin, we'd like to introduce a new personality on our show, Mr. Trevor Black.
Hello, everyone. Thank you. I've been trying to make a meeting. Unfortunately, as a actually working photographer, I often don't get weekends off. But finally, it's too cold for anyone to want to have a wedding, so I'm actually here. Yay!
Well, we're glad to have you. So, we're going to start off with Mr. John Meadows, and what camera do you take out when it's minus 20?
Well, when I take a camera out in this kind of ungodly cold weather, two things matter. It needs to be big enough that I can use gloves or mittens, and I really don't like batteries or electronic shutters, so I take out my my Hasselblad. I also like the fact that interchangeable film backs, because I find the worst thing about shooting in the cold is not so much the shooting, it's reloading film. So if I can go out, you know, with three backs or four, then I'm happy, and I find the Hasselblad shutters, knock on wood, have not seized up in the cold weather. And of course, no battery means no meter. But of course, on a sunny winter day like this, you're doing sunny 16 plus your plus two stops for the snow. You don't really need much of a meter. I also like the fact that it's a large enough camera. Like, as much as I would love a Tessina 35 millimeter twin lens reflex camera that's the size of a dinky toy, you can't use that in minus infinity, whereas Hasselblad, nice and big. And in fact, one of the things I have on my 80 millimeter lens, I have a focusing lever, which, because it's a fairly stiff focusing example of that lens. And that is great, because, you know, you can use mittens and you are shooting just fine. Works for me.
Okay, yeah, no, I've been taking out my Hasselblad in the cold too. And the one thing I was most concerned about was adjusting the exposure settings. And even with gloves, I actually found it quite easy on the 80. So that's fantastic. And mine hasn't seized up either. So, yeah, knock on wood.
We said before, Alex, and I won't go into the list, that I said if I want to do an episode on which of my cameras don't work in cold weather, we'd be here till tomorrow morning.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I finally had my Hasselblad not work in the wintertime. I was out with Mike, actually. It was New Year's Day, actually.
Yeah, New Year's Day down in Burlington.
We were down at the lakeshore at Lake Ontario there, so the wind coming off the lake must have done something to my Hassie. It was the first time I actually had any issues with that camera, and it was strange. The barn doors at the back, one of them stuck a little bit open after the shutter was released, and I basically had to pull the lens apart, pull it apart, uncock the shutter in the in the lens, and basically just give the body a tap. So anyway, since then, I've had the pleasure of meeting Joe Vieira, who is our local Hasselblad guy here in Toronto.
And yeah, hopefully, no, he's even trained by the factory.
Yeah, and I hopefully we're going to have him do a guest spot one time. Hopefully John can interview him.
But I'll work him over, because he did work on my Hasselblad.
Yep.
Tried to fix my 80, but then told me that he thought it had been dropped at some point in the past. Okay. So guess what's on my shopping list this year?
Yeah.
But his one thing I was saying to James on the way here today was that he shows so much pride in the work he does, and that's rare.
Yeah, and it's incredible to see his shop and the tools and the stuff that he's saved from working at the factory for so many years. Mm-hmm. And just to see how the precision and the alignment and what goes into what makes a Hassie work was just an eye-opening experience. If anyone's local in the area or has any issues with their current Hasselblad equipment or is looking for Hasselblad equipment, I think we could probably put Joe's contact info in the show notes. But,
oh, absolutely.
And hopefully we will get him on the show at some point. But
I've got an 80 millimeter lens that needs some love. It's been giving me grief for the past year or so. And at some point I got to get to Joe's place. Worst case, I'm probably buying a new lens from him.
Yeah, I'm trading my 80 C lens for an 80 CF with Joe. He's going to source one out, and he's actually given me a really good price on an upgrade. So
awesome!
Definitely recommend going, especially in the wintertime too. What I find from shooting my Hassie is the CF lenses are so much easier to use in the cold than the C lenses. Just the adjustment, the rings are just a little bit easier when you're wearing gloves and stuff. So. Yeah.
Well, like John, one of the primary things I look for in a winter camera is the capability of using it with gloves. So I use the Mamiya M645. And I even have the Deluxe L Grip. So, I mean, I could probably use this wearing mittens, and it would work perfectly. Now, it is battery-driven, but the grip does add a bit of extra layer of insulation onto it. And I, again, have shot it out in some of the cold temperatures that we had between Christmas and New Year's. And the thing has not failed me. Everything on it is chunky, from the aperture ring, especially on the new series lenses, the shutter speed dial, and the film advance. Now, I also don't, unfortunately, have a working meter on mine. I do have the eye level meter, but not it doesn't actually work. But no, even for, with all the cold, it's just perfect out there. It's never let me down. I've taken it out three or four times, and it's just gone out, shot the 15, and left. Of course, the problem does come when reloading film. You have magazines inserts rather than fully contained magazines, so fiddling around getting a roll of film reloaded is a bit of trouble. But, you know, you pop into a coffee shop, pull it out, and sit down, warm yourself up, and then go back out and shoot the next roll.
Or a bar. Have a couple of shots.
Yeah, that would warm you up.
And see if you can actually load it the third roll.
I have to agree with Alex, actually. I have a 645 as well, and I haven't had an issue in the cold weather either.
Yeah. And even if you don't have the grip, the two-body shutter releases are big enough that you can tell them apart, especially the top one, which... Mm-hmm. Which I think is fantastic, especially if you're using with it the waist level finder.
Yep.
Yeah. And Mr. James Lee, you just got something.
I did.
So tell us about your recent purchase.
So those that don't know, it's about 12. Well, we had a scheduled start time about 12:30 this morning or this afternoon here. And there happens to be a Camarama show, which is basically a local swap meet here in Toronto. And so I decided, you know, before we started recording, I'm going to go just see what's there. Maybe I'll grab some expired film. But
you did the same thing that I avoided Camarama
yes,
for.
Yes. And I, it's not like me to just buy cameras on impulse, right?
Yeah, no, not at all.
Never.
Sure.
Really?
Why?
Really missed you. Really, Mr. Lee?
Well, okay. Well, it's all of a sudden it's so warm in here. Anyway,
nose is growing.
What's that smell?
Something is steaming.
So I am. I'm going to give the perspective on this is going to be one of my winter cameras to shoot. The Hassie is one of my favorites, as well as the Mamiya, or pardon me, the Leica Flex SL2 to shoot in the wintertime because it's very easy to use with gloves on. But I'm going to talk about my most recent acquisition, whose use is intended for a lot of winter shooting, and it's the Fuji GSW 690 version 2 that I have. This is the 90mm non-interchangeable lens version. I believe it's a 95.6, I think. Or am I lying? Oh, actually, never mind. This is not the 90 version. This is the good one. This is the... You'd think I would inspect cameras better before I buy them. It was very dark in there, but this is the 65mm version. So this is actually the one that I wanted. This is... I want to shoot some good landscapes with it. So, anyway, a little bit about the camera that I know about it. So the 672... was launched in the early 90s, mid-80s, I believe. So 1985, thereabouts, is when the camera was launched. There's basically three versions of this camera. There's the GSW 690, which was released in about 1980. Fuji made a 65 f/8, a 65 5.6 interchangeable lenses for that particular one, and then the 690 that was released in 85, they added a hot shoe, but the ability to interchange the lens was taken away. Interesting camera. It's got something new on it that I'm not too familiar about, which is a 4 exposure 120, which, based on my quick research before starting the recording here, is the 4 exposure 120 was meant for a half roll 120, which is something I've never come across in my experience. So certainly if there are any listeners out there that have come across and want to share some information about half roll 120, that'd be really interesting to learn more about it. Basically what it has a switch on the top of the body that you can switch from a 16 exposure 220 roll, which makes sense, and an 8 exposure 120, and then it has a 4 exposure 120 setting, which seems rather peculiar. No meter on this camera. It's a rangefinder. For such a gigantic camera, this is for, I didn't mention it earlier, but this is the Texas Leica that we're talking about here. So it's a 6x9 negative that you get out of it. It has no meter. It's fully mechanical, therefore really, really easy and simple to use in the wintertime. As far as winter use, the lens is huge, so the focus ring is easy to operate. The shutter speed and aperture controls are on the side, on the barrel of the lens, with two big switches on either side. So as long as you remember which side you're controls what function on the lens, it's a very, very straightforward, simple camera to use. Simple to load. It reminds me a lot of loading a Pentax 67. So 120 roll in the back, both spools are removable. I suspect it would be a little bit of a pain in the rear end to load in cold weather. Same issues that I've experienced with the Pentax 67 is when you're loading that 120 film in the back, is very similar to an SLR setup. Getting that spool just in there the right way to grab onto the spindles can be a bit of a pain. But other than that, it's really simple to use, one solid hand grip. I'm not sure the construction. It's got a plastic shell, a hard plastic shell on it. It's exceptionally light for such a big camera. Like, I would say this camera probably weighs less than 1 pound, just given the size of it. Is pretty good. I have yet to see the image quality. I did just load a roll of T-Max 400 in it, so I'll be taking a few shots in and around the taping today. So hopefully they turn out really well. But it looks like it's going to be a real solid, good user camera for the winter time. So
yeah,
and I can't wait to shoot some landscape, some slides with it in the summer. Oh, so
chrome would look beautiful on that, especially 6x9.
Well, you know what they say about 6x9.
Wine me, dine me, 6x9 me.
Wine me, dine me, 6x9 me. Now I have to come up with an even better saying for the end of this recording.
There we go.
Be prepared to be let down.
You'll have to top that one, so to speak.
Is that before or after the 6x9?
That's what she said.
James, just a note about that 4-frame. I have an idea that it might actually be for clip tests. That you can actually set it so it only shoots 4, and then you can like leave the rest of the roll in there and change it in a dark bag, so then you can do a clip test and take it to the lab, which is something that they used to do, to make sure your exposures are fine, and then you would be able to continue shooting for the rest of the day.
No, actually they did release a short version of 120.
Really?
Yeah,
they did.
Because you wouldn't need a switch if you wanted to run. If you wanted to run a short roll of 120, you could just stop and pull it out.
Yeah. But it might have been like a kind of like, oh, look, we could do it for you sort of thing.
I don't know. Who knows what's going on at Fuji?
Fuji,
I mean,
not film?
Yeah, Fuji, like, just...
They're evil.
Yeah, you're in my bad books right now. Better not kill the rest of Akros, you jackasses. Fargles.
Say it. Say it.
Yeah, F-U-G.
Woo.
Nice.
And watch James Lee go all John Wick.
There you go.
Come on, tell us how you really feel.
Tell us how you really feel.
F-U-G.
Don't. Bill, you have a very familiar camera in front of you.
Your
cold weather choice.
Yes. I do a lot of cold weather photography. I ski in the winter. I've been skiing for 43 years. And since I really got serious about photography, of course, the camera comes along for the ride because, again, you got landscapes on the way up, landscapes on the way back, and sometimes I'll take pictures while skiing.
Look, now, there's a tree.
And yet another tree.
Why is it getting closer?
So, you're kind of constrained on, okay, you can't lug anything super-duper heavy with you. And the Nikon FM2, and again, there's a story behind this. I've been sort of a Nikon guy for a very long time. And I've shot F2 in the cold, and it's okay up until minus 10, and after that it can get a little problematic. But the FM2, Government of Canada in the high Arctic used Nikon FM2s for the longest time because the shutters just kept on going in minus 40 and below. The really, really cold weather, which we'll just start crying uncontrollably when that wind chill hits. But I have never had an issue with the FM2 seizing up and when wind chills of minus 30-something temperatures. I just recently uploaded some photos to my Flickr account on a day just like that while skiing. And it's like, wow, not a problem at all. And a few weeks before, I was at my brother's place in the beaches in Toronto. And again, my F2, it was struggling after a while. So, yeah, if you're looking for a cold weather camera, anything with a vertical Copal shutter, Nikon FM2 is great. The Nikon FM is great. If it's a mechanical camera with a vertical focal shutter or a leaf shutter, you're fine. If it's a horizontal cloth or metal, it's good to a certain point, and after that, it's like all bets are off. And I think the worst camera for this sort of weather would probably be the Canon A series. And I've never had luck with my Pentax Spotmatic in cold weather. But again, the saying goes, your mileage may vary.
Yeah, I was shooting my F2 in the cold weather, and it was starting to struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the FM2 in the high Arctic, that's not surprising. But with the all-metal construction on the body, it might be the reason why they kept using it. It was already frozen to their hands, and they couldn't let it go.
Exactly.
Very true.
Well, it's time for the FNG. You have an absolutely gorgeous camera to share about.
Well, I recently was at Downtown Camera looking for stuff for another brand, which I will not mention as it might upset James. And that while I was checking out, right next to the used department, I looked down and found myself a near mint condition Contax N1 two lens system. comes with a 24-85 and the 70-300, and it's one of those dream cameras I always wanted when I was younger, and thought, oh, that'd be nice if I had $5,000. But now, Boxing Day sales, you can acquire this system for a lot less. So, anyway, so I decided to get it, and on a whim, and I love it. Seeing that it uses lithium batteries, lithium batteries generally are a bit better in colder weather situations. And literally 2 days after I acquired this camera that I was able to test it. When I was with a couple of friends down in the waterworks area of the east end of Toronto called the Beaches. And that it was, as we are having a cold snap, lovely to photograph like frozen branches and trees and stuff. Mm. And that we have some water breaks and stuff and trees, and it was great for photographing. But we had a 50-kilometer wind, and it was about negative 30 degrees. And I thought, well, if that's going to test a brand-new camera in the cold weather, nothing else will. And that as it is big and chunky, I was literally wearing mitts pretty much the first time I used this thing. The whole thing was easy to – I did load the film, I will admit, in the car. But everything else I was able to use, adjust everything with mitts on. And that it survived – it did not slow down. The battery didn't kind of say, no more, thank you very much. Yeah. And it held up for the entire situation. Mm-hmm. Where my friends was it Canon EOS 5 mirrorless system. The battery died on him. My friend's D90, the batteries died on him, and this continued working. And this is a film camera. So that's why I thought I'd bring my little friend along.
Yeah, now this is the Kyocera made.
Yes, yes, camera. It is.
So it's using the contact's name.
Yeah.
And the Kyocera licensed Zeiss optics.
Yes.
Which there's nothing wrong about. I have the Contax G2 and exact same build, exact same optics. So
yeah. At the time when I've read read reviews, they're saying its main competitor were basically the F100 and the F4 or F5 at the time, from other manufacturers. It's just that this was such an expensive camera at the time. Mm-hmm. People went towards those other brands. Right. So now they only made, because it was made for a limited amount of time, there was only 6 lenses ever made for it. And they were all very expensive. So there's not a lot out there on the used market. Yeah. And if you can, you're still going to pay a fortune for it. I mean, like a 50 for this is going to be over $800. And the whole thing is still AF. So, I mean, that's the thing. They made a line of AF lenses for this, only for this. So
it's a proprietary mount.
Yes, and there's no aftermarket, there's nothing. It's they've got the 24 to 85, the 70 to 300, the 35 1.4, the 50 1.4, the 85 1.4 and the 100 macro.
They've got you by the short and curlies.
Yes. Oh man, and it's curly.
But it's T-Star.
But it sounds so nice.
I suppose that's better than being short.
So yeah, I've tested it in low weather and or low temperatures and I love it.
Nice. Well, it is a gorgeous-looking camera.
Thank you.
Wow.
You have to leave it here, by the way.
one-eight-thousandth of a second top shutter speed.
Is it all Zeiss glass?
Wow.
It's all Zeiss glass. Yes, made by Kyocera, but still, it's beautiful and sharp.
That's a stunning piece of kit.
And you could take the Kyocera-built Zeiss and put up against the German-built Zeiss and...
Just exactly like the G2 lenses.
You had me
at
Zeiss.
Yeah.
You know what they say about Zeiss? Zeiss is nice and twice the price.
Just twice?
Mike, what camera do you got for us?
Well, I've got the Canon LAN 7NE. That would be the one with the eye focus. It's actually a lot of fun to use. I find that in low light, it can get a little jumpy. But go outside, bright light, I have it just following my eye across. I just put on AI servo, and I can just watch my subject walk right across the frame, and it'll follow my eye, and it'll focus on every single point as they walk through.
Nice.
It's actually unreal.
Now, question about the eye focus.
Yeah.
Who did it first, Canon or Minolta?
I'm pretty sure that was Minolta.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it was Minolta, but...
Just curious.
Yeah, no, Canon perfected it. So well, there's a reason why Minolta stopped and Canon continued, because they just got better at it.
So what makes it a good winter camera?
Well, same sort of scenario that that Trevor had. I mean, the cold weather we have, the lithium-ion battery, and it would not stop firing. The thing is just phenomenal. I had my phone actually died. Stuck in my pocket. I took it out just to check the time. Phone was dead. I had full battery, nothing. Dead, flat, finished. So I gave up with the phone. I've used... They're taking pictures. Isn't Bill's cute? Look at that with his little Zeiss.
That's not little. That ain't little. It weighs more than your camera.
It's short. It's not little.
Stumpy.
Oh boy, yeah, we're a little lost. Oh, my, the contact brings out the worst in us.
Getting out of hand now.
CCR after hours. Welcome.
Meanwhile, back in minus 20.
Yeah. Okay, so back in minus 20 weather, using that camera. Well, I found that for the most part, since it's autofocus, I don't have to worry about having my hand on the lens to focus. I can just use it straight, just balance. It's got two small dials. One is the infamous spin dial right on the back, which is great. Everybody that has a modern DSLR, they've got that little thumb wheel right on the back of the camera. Yeah. It makes life so much easier. And then the one right behind the shutter button, specifically just to spin up your... Whatever setting you're currently set to. If you're set to aperture priority, you spin it and you drop down the numbers on your aperture. And then on thumb wheel, you've got exposure compensation. And then if you go full manual, then you've got shutter control on the top and aperture on the back. So I find that probably using mitts wouldn't work too well. I'll have to say that. But using some nice thermal insulated gloves, you could easily have a really, really good experience shooting that camera, even in the bitter cold. And since it's not heavy, it's not fairly chunky, it's actually a really nice weighted camera, and it feels really good in the hand, especially with throw a 50 mil on there, and you're good to go.
Absolutely. Now, Donna, Bill mentioned that the A-series Canons weren't exactly good in the cold. What do you have to say in response, since what camera are you talking about?
I think I would have to disagree with Bill. I'm talking about the Canon A1 today for my cold weather camera. I really like using this camera in the winter. I've used it quite a couple of times, actually, in minus degree weather.
Minus degree.
Stop looking at me. Yes, I've used this camera quite a lot in cold weather temperatures. What I really like about it, though, is, I don't know about you, but in the cold, you really don't want to be carrying around something big, bulky, and heavy. This camera can definitely be put away in your pocket. You don't have to necessarily carry it around your neck, although it is a very lightweighted camera. And yes, even though it is battery-operated, I have never had an issue in the cold. And I brought this down even to the lake. It was pretty cold down there, and I had gloves on, and I was still able to use the camera with no issues. Nice. I've never had an issue with it in the cold weather at all. I definitely would recommend it.
We were out in bitter cold.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, speaking, actually, that was one thing that she mentioned, was about the size and the weight of the camera. And John was mentioning about the Hasselblad. Loading 120 film in winter, it does suck, because you do need a little bit of motor control and hand-eye coordination. You need a little bit of precision getting it into the spools. I can't deny about that. And that's actually one of the things that I really like about my Elan, is loading it in the cold is really simple. Just pop the back, throw a film in, and you can literally, even with mitts, pull it across, close the back, it's loaded. Yeah. Nothing else.
That's the right idea, though, with the different backings?
Yeah, the backs are good. Absolutely, you can change films mid-roll. That's great. Mm-hmm. But once you're done, and it can be a bit of a pain and a challenge to load.
Yeah, I think the worst camera I have, I'm breaking my promise, I'll only talk about one bad winter camera.
That's fine.
One of my, in other respects, favorite cameras, Kodak Medalist. It's tricky to load in the summer. It's very, very finicky. And I tried, I think, one of our meetups at the Distillery District. It was cold. And, you're starting to lose feeling in your fingers. And there's just no way you can load something like that. I'm sure we all have fiddly cameras like that that just don't, you know, are not glove friendly. I want something that's glove friendly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was jokingly saying Leica in the background, so is Donna. But it depends on the particular model. Like, if you look at the early Barnacks, I would really hate to be loading one of those in the winter. At least with the more modern M series, it does have the little back door that you can open, and it does make it a little bit easier to load. But
imagine
still,
loading those Barnacks on a U-boat in the middle of the Atlantic.
In the dark.
It gives you respect. Hunted by destroyers.
For the journalists that are,
and getting bombarded by depth charges from the Brits and the Americans and the Canadians.
And the Canadians.
Did you have an issue with an A camera?
Yes.
Donna just asked if Bill had an issue with one of his A cameras.
My first AE-1, long time ago, galaxy far, far away, when the world was young. My second camera, first one, we'll talk at a later episode. The A1, I took it out on a cold day. Yeah, I was good for about maybe a dozen frames. The camera died.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was like minus 15.
Wow.
Oh, okay.
And it was just sort of like, okay, we just don't take this one out.
Yeah. That's weird.
Well, we've talked about abusing cameras in cold weather, but what about the actual stuff we put in it?
Film abuse. That's what it's all about. We beat it up.
At Classic Camera Revival, love to push the film we shoot to the absolute limit of what it can take. And that's the one thing that struck me, especially with Trevor, when I first met him, was the amount of abuse he put film through in his work as a photojournalist. Trevor, definitely we'd like to hear about some of the stuff that you've done to film just to get the shot and make the press deadline.
Well, thank you very much. One of the things that I learned from a old, literally Vietnam war-torn photojournalist teacher of mine is how to basically abuse film. And I never had to do anything like he had to. Developing in a like military tent urinal.
I was thinking more of a river in the middle of the jungle that was filled with blood.
He would get out of the blood first, so that to make sure that he wasn't shot.
Tell us more about developing in a urinal.
You can use urine as stop bath, and sometimes if you've got just a little bit of developer, similar to something in a little can like you have right there, and you just basically tinkle all over it, you stop it long enough developing that you can actually sit it into an enlarger, make a print before the film is toast. And that, because sometimes you have nothing on the field with you. Wow. And that's it.
Well, I've used some piss poor developers.
I never had to go that far.
Oh, touche.
But there have been times that there's, a sports event or a political event or a car crash or something like that that I have to soup it really, really fast. So basically, to do it was to basically push the film to say, because we used to always shoot Tri-X and didn't know what lighting situation we're going to get into. So just automatically shoot at 1600 and then crank the heat up. So instead of 68 degrees, like do it at 72 or something like that and agitate the hoo-hoo out of it to just get it developed quickly, get enough, you know, contrast and tonality, and then develop it in like 6 minutes or something like that, and then speed develop it, just hair dry it, and then try to put it in the enlarger to get a print. So yeah, it's not the, you know, war Vietnam style, but we still had to get it pretty quick so that it would hit the press and be on time. And like some hockey games, because I used to photograph OHL, and the lighting in some of those stadiums at Belleville and Kingston are horrendous. And that even pushing it to, like, the lights would go off in the middle of the game, so you'd have to shoot it now at 32. And Tri-X is good, but, like, you're really pushing it at 32. Da-dum dum, ha ha, yes. And the pun of the day goes to. Trying to make it not so contrasty, especially when you got like people, you know, on white ice and just like, you know, black and white uniforms, or the Belleville Bulls, or was it Kingston Frontenacs, had black uniforms. So they're basically black uniforms against white ice and in the dark.
3200 Tri-X. Yeah, you're lucky.
Exactly, with D76. So,
oh.
Yeah, exactly. So, the grain was the size of Fruit Loops, and you'd have to pull it back somehow. So that's those are some of the things we had to do. So there you go.
And people are worried about sitting in front of a computer screen and being like, oh, the light was too bright. Come on. Way beyond that.
Yeah, there's too much noise on my ISO 800 digital camera.
The shadows are really bad. I'll fix that in Photoshop.
Yeah.
Hey, let's not forget the face smoothing. That was fantastic.
Oh, the face smoothing? Oh, man. That is for the win.
Yeah.
Now, Tri-X has always been my go-to film to shoot in any situation where I have no clue what's going on. And again, I found that you can push and pull that film and basically make it do whatever you want it to. Yeah. And Bill has put out some great results with Tri-X.
Yes, I have. And back in November, I belonged to a sister group called Toronto Photo Walks, and they had their anniversary walk, and we were down in the distillery district in Toronto, which is in the Don Valley. And of course, it happened on the grayest, most miserable day of the year.
You'll have to narrow it down a bit.
Polished pewter. That's a running joke that John Meadows and I have, where there are 1,001 different phrases for to describe the Southern Ontario skies between October and May. Polished pewter is today's phrase. I pushed to 1600 ISO. Before the walk, I was downtown Toronto. I took some shots of the new pedestrian walkway across Queen Street between Eaton Centre and the Hudson's Bay Company. And then later, I was up in the distillery, not distillery district, the brickworks. Sorry, I'm getting old. I mixed them up. That's a little frightening. So the Don Valley Brickworks. And in the corner, Donna's laughing and going, "It's going to happen to you soon."
Damn right.
The results sort of speak for themselves. I pushed in HC110 dilution B. It's got a gritty look to it, but it's actually, the tonality is really smooth.
It's nice. Yeah.
Now, I don't want to spring something on you. I also pulled film. I pulled Acros 100 in medium format down to ISO 32 to shoot the waterfalls in Waterdown.
Okay.
A few years back. As I didn't have any neutral density filters for a Mamiya C220. Turned out good.
Nice. Well, speaking of ISO 32, some of the folks around the table probably remember an amazing Kodak film with an awesome name called Panatomic X. Absolutely one of my favorite films. Unfortunately, Kodak ended that film sometime in the 80s?
I think so.
They pulled a Fuji.
Yeah, pretty much. Mid-80s, okay. Well, I was I had bought a couple of rolls off the Film Photography Projects store. They get the film in occasionally. I think they're out currently. But so this wasn't actually a bulk-loaded roll. It was actually commercial film. And when I opened up the box on the top of the film canister, it said, "This product has been discontinued. Please replace with T-Max 100. T-Max is not Panatomic X. First of all, it's a T-grain film rather than a traditional, a classic grain film. But it got me thinking, what if I took T-Max 100 and pulled it to ASA 32? So I thought, like, well, you know, that's a good idea. And I was still fairly new to developing my own film, not nearly as cavalier as I am now. But sure enough, on the massive dev chart, there was a time for between ASA 25 and ASA 64 in Xtol 1:1, 8 3/4 minutes. So I did it. And the results are pretty darn close to Panatomic X. Not perfect, because again, T-grain film versus classic, but it produced the same smooth tonality and fine-grained nature that you'd come to expect from Panatomic X. Now, I've also done this with RPX 100, and I've gotten the same results, and I've also done it with the ASA 25 times with Rodinal, with RPX 100 at 32, because I did that. I shot the roll only to realize that my Xtol had died. So, yeah, it was yellow. You'd almost mistake it for urine to stop your film in. And sure enough, it works. So, yeah, it's just, you want to get that look, then, yeah, T-Max or RPX 100, shoot it at 32 and soup it in Xtol or Rodinal, and you'll get the closest thing to Panatomic X that you can still shoot.
Without shooting Panatomic X.
Exactly. And yeah. I'm lucky in the sense that I currently have 5 rolls sitting around of Panatomic X that are two of them are coming with me to Montreal in April. So
very nice.
It's an amazing film.
Oh,
I miss it.
Hopefully Kodak will bring it back after they get Ektachrome on the market.
Well, we'll see. I think, what are they saying for Ektachrome?
April 2018 is when it's supposed to be rolling out, but we'll see.
Panatomic X would be...
Panatomic X and Plus X.
Yeah, I'd like. I wouldn't mind seeing TechPan come back too.
Oh, that stuff is amazing.
I love TechPan.
Sure, why don't we just start pushing it and say like HIE?
Somebody pinch me. I'm dreaming again.
Well, I'm gonna make everyone sick. I gave my brother two boxes of 4x5 TechPan.
Very nice. Oh,
you're a nice brother.
Yes.
Will you adopt me?
Did he give you a Leica M3 in return?
I already have an M3. It was my dad's.
Okay, M4.
I have an M4 too.
What are you doing with your Leica? What are you doing with it in an underpass?
Now, we've been talking a lot about film stocks, but not much about chemistry. But one of the best two best chemistries to use for extreme pushes with film are Accufine and Diafine. And James happens to have a couple each.
Yeah. So I, whenever I'm abusing film intentionally, those are in black and white, of course. These are the two developers that I tend to gravitate to. I would say I prefer Diafine over Accufine when it comes to pushing. I like the compensating characteristics of Diafine as a developer.
Don't get that ridiculous contrast curve of either black or white.
Well, yeah, it's that's the whole secret, I think, of a compensating developer is it compresses down the highlight tonality, and which is, you know, if you're going to be abusing film, is where you're going to want to save as much detail, I guess, as much as possible, as well as it keeps the shadow detail up as well, too, when essentially you're over-processing film. So, you know, really, not to get too technical about it, but what happens with film, if you're abusing it or pushing it, it generally is a linear tone curve, which means basically black and white, nothing in the middle. And the compensating developer, when you're souping it for longer periods or if the exposure is a little bit off, it for whatever reason, the way the chemistry is made up with Diafine, it compensates in just a standard process. Like, you're not doing stand development or anything like that. You're doing, you know, regular 3 minute in each solution with a standard agitation pattern for those films. So it works really, really well. It's a simple developer to use. It's a two-part solution, A and B. And essentially for all films, and you don't even compensate time with this developer, it's 3 minutes in solution A. Pour your solution A back into your working solution, in your stock solution. And solution B, 3 minutes, put that back in your B bottle. And this stuff, this will survive the apocalypse. It's what we'll be drinking with the cockroaches, I think. So, you know, highly recommend it. You know, there's other techniques that you can use when it comes to abusing film. And a lot of that is, a lot of times we use this technique for long exposure work as well. And it's semi-stand developing. And the whole premise behind that stuff. And you can use a couple of developers that come to mind for that stuff is HC-110.
Rodinal.
Rodinal. And the Rodinal, you'd probably start at like a 1 to 100 dilution, and you're probably looking at like a dilution H or something like that for HC-110, even or even more dilute. And the whole premise behind stand developing is trying to control the physical reaction around the highlight areas of the negative, right? So basically what that means is the more exposure that the silver halide has had in the highlight areas, the more reactive it's going to be around the chemicals. So it's going to theoretically develop faster. And if it develops faster, it has a tendency, obviously, to overdevelop, and then you get blown highlights. So the reason you use stand developing is you keep the chemicals as still as possible, so the chemicals around the highlight areas of the negative get exhausted quickly. Yeah. And because you're so dilute, you're not risking overdeveloping the shadow and mid-tone areas of your film. And it does work really well. It is, I got to thank Mike and Alex for that, for the tip that they gave me for long exposures with Akros and pushing Akros and doing long exposures with it in semi-stand development. Works like a dream.
Absolutely. And yeah. With Rodinal, basically the rule of thumb that I've come across is if it's 1 to 100, it's an hour. 1 to 200, 2 hours. I'd love to try 1 to 300 for 3 hours, see if that works.
When you get to
maybe?
The when you
I've get done to, 1 to 300 for standard developing with ADOX CMS2 at EI 20. I shot it at, or no, I didn't shoot it at 20. I shot it at I'm tempted to say about ISO 3.
Okay.
And I did Rodinal 1 to 200 or 1 to 300. I think it was 1 to 300 to do the pull. Mm-hmm. And the results, I mean, it's like this film is razor sharp as it is. And I mean, absolutely. Pulling it back to that, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah. The one thing you do have to watch out for, especially if you're stand developing 35 millimeter, is bromide drag. So you do need to add one or two inversions about halfway through, and that gets rid of it. I found that when I did an HC110 monobath with 35 millimeter Tri-X, and the results are great, but... You look in the highlights, you can actually see the streaks from where the sprocket holes are. Not so much if you're shooting 120 or 4x5.
Yeah.
Rod and I've done stand developing FP4 and RPX 400 in 4x5, and I've used the SP445 tank. Perfect for that.
Yeah. Rodinal, thankfully, won't give you the bromide drag, just simply there's no bromide in Rodinal, but... Because of convection inside the tank, you can actually get surge marks of the fluid going through the sprocket holes, and you get surge marks. It's very similar to bromide drag, and it's very easy to confuse it too, but it's the same thing. Absolutely. If you agitate too quickly too, you can get surge marks through the sprocket holes.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the semi-stand approach.
It does help a lot with surge marks.
You've been doing a lot of work with Tri-X and T-Max.
Yeah.
And pushing them all the way up to 3,200.
Yeah. And so, like, for the Tri-X, like, and this is a recipe I found on someone's Flickr page. It's for 3,200, though. I think it's closer, like, 1,600, 3,200, sort of in the middle. I think it depends on the subject matter.
Yeah.
It's a 2-hour semi-stand in Tri-X, or, I'm sorry, in Rodinal. Develop film, another film. And so basically what it is, it's a, you know, 1 minute, you know, the typical sort of with Rodinal, you want a gentle agitation regardless.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And then after that, every 30 minutes, it is one gentle inversion.
Yep.
And the results, even in 35 millimeter, are the contrast is not bad and the grain is better than you might think. So that's my go-to for Tri-X. More recently, one thing I will say about Rodinal, we're talking about the really, really wild dilutions like 1 to 100, 200, 300. You need to keep an eye on what the minimum amount of active developer is.
Yeah.
So that if you're developing 1 to 300, even if you're developing, let's say, 35 millimeter in a steel tank, which means not a lot of solution, I think for Rodinal, they say you want to have at least 5 milliliters of Rodinal.
Five milliliters is pretty standard. Yeah. That's what it is for HC110 as well.
The other thing I wanted to mention, T-Max, this is my recent discovery, and I want to do more work with it, is T-Max 400 is beautiful at an EI of 1600, 3200 when developed. There's a recipe, and I don't remember the number of minutes, but we'll get it for the show notes. In T-Max Developer 1+4, I shot a roll in 120, and it doesn't even look pushed, to my mind.
That's T-Max Developer. It's a beautiful compensating developer.
The contrast is great. Now, of course, 120, it's not all that fair to talk about grain, but it didn't have that distressed look. So I think that's become my go-to. I just don't need to do more testing of it in 35 millimeter.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, speaking of distressed look, you can get...
Is that what Donna is every morning?
Well, Mike certainly knows how to distress film, especially with his work with Polypan F.
Yeah, Polypan F, I've done like some absolutely ridiculous pushes and ridiculous pulls with this, and every single time I've gotten at least one or two usable images. I've pushed it as far up as roughly around 3,200. However, it gets really super thin and really tough to pull anything out, but there is a faint image even up at 3,200.
And just so that folks know, this is nominally an ASA 50 film.
Yeah, at best 50. Usually I'm more shoot it between 25 and 32. That's my go-to speed for this film. I have gone down as far as 3. I have tried at 1.5, but it just took too long. And I kind of put the camera down, forgot what was loaded. And then next thing I know, I'm just shooting. Ah, it's got to probably polypan. And I'm just shooting it at 50. And then I just clued in because when I rewound it and I looked at the leader of the film, which is, I should put it probably on the outside of the camera, not on the inside. It said EI 1.5 polypan pull test. And I looked at it and I said, oh, damn it. That's not right. I just shot the rest of it at 50. Oops. So whatever. I just souped it, let the thing fall apart where it's going to fall apart, and said, to hell with it, whatever. I mean, it's polypan. I've beaten the hell out of this so many times. Whatever. I'll find something that I can use. But one of the things that I have done is I've shot it regularly at 200 and regularly at 400. And at 200 is almost no grain to speak of, considering that, for one, it's a sort of two-stop, almost three-stop push, give or take what you regularly consider that the film speed is. And it's very sharp. There's very fine grain. And I really like it at more towards the 200, 100, 200 range, because I find the contrast curve is it's a little bit steeper, and I like the more contrast that it pushes out.
Right.
It's a fantastic film. It's really sad that it's no more. But as far as I've tested it also with Diafine, as James was mentioning, and one of the things that I've learned about with Diafine is you can expose a roll of film, multiple different exposures on that roll. Let's say it was a 100 speed film, you rated it at 100, 200, 400, 800, whatever. You can develop it exactly the same. You should get a usable negative, provided that the film doesn't basically fall apart in the shadows.
Right.
And you should get something to use up to, I think, about a three-stop push on usual.
Yeah. I use Diafine basically for any found film that I have a curiosity.
That makes perfect sense.
In developing, is you never know. Or, you know, or if you forgot to label something and you're like, I don't know, did I push, did I pull, what did I do?
Yeah, it should bring you something.
Yeah, and anytime I'm unsure about high contrast scenes, so like if I've not taken good notes, if I've been out on a shoot or something like that, it's a good sort of catch-all developer.
Yeah, it'll really take care of both the highlights and the shadow detail and try to compress them.
You know, one of the things we haven't talked about is abusing color film.
Yeah, and I've done a little bit with that now.
I tend to confuse myself or get easily confused about whether or not I put Ektar or if I put Portra 400 in my camera. And I constantly screw it up and never change the ISO in my camera. So I have unintentionally abused the ever-living snot out of Portra 400 over the years.
But you can.
But because you can.
It's a beautiful snot.
It's...
Coda Press used to be very good for pushing and pulling. We used to use that all the time with the newspaper.
Yeah. But, like, 200 up to 1600. You can soup... Portra 400 for an extra 1.5 to 3 minutes at 1600 EI 1600, and it's incredibly good.
You don't even have to. I've shot Portra 400 on the same roll. Now this was 120. I've shot it from down to 100 up to 1600, same roll through the Hasselblad. We were getting a tour of a water treatment plant down in Asheville, North Carolina, legally.
Wow, I'm impressed.
I know.
Congratulations.
We pretended to be students.
Very nice.
Yeah, engineering
students. Legal under false pretenses.
Yes.
Yeah, that's pretty much how they arranged it. And I basically had my Gossen Luna 6F. And if I was outside, it was 100, 200, 400, 800, 1600. And I just ran it through normal developing times in a C41 home developing kit and got results out of everything.
Yeah, I've done it in 35. The negative at 1600 starts to get a little bit thin, but it is unbelievable the amount of detail and information you can pull up.
Portra 400 at 800 in 35mm. I like the it has much more of more of a punch.
I would agree with you 100%. Like there's, in terms of modern emulsions, like emulsions in say the last 15 to 20 years, Portra 400, like, I know, you know, like, I do miss VC and NC. I miss you because, you know, that's what I grew up with, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But Portra 400 is is got to be hands down, like definitely in my book anyway, one of the top three in C41 that's available today.
Absolutely.
You know, like there's nothing that really comes close.
Konica. The old Konica 3200 C41 film back in like the 90s or something, like about 20 years ago, that stuff sucked. It like literally looked like a bowl of Fruit Loops. I know I mentioned that earlier, but I mean, like, when you looked at the grain in a 4x6 or even an 8x10, it was nasty.
A bowl of Fruit Loops, that's...
But what color were the one. Fruit Loops? Yeah. Yeah. Generally with Portra, I expose at 200 ISO. Now, I did push, and again, I didn't do the processing myself. Someone else did. A Provia 400, I pushed it to 1600.
Oh, I've heard really, really good results with Provia 400 at 16.
And I ran it through my Canon at QL G317 rangefinder on one of the cold, I think it was like a winter solstice event at Kensington Market.
Nice.
If you go deep into my Flickr profile, you'll find the photos, I think. And great colors. And again...
And no shifting.
No. No, it was pretty good. Now, granted, it was silly cold, and yeah, some of the shots weren't that sharp as interpretive, but again, it was super cold, and I was like, my hands were shaking, and yeah.
Well, speaking of shaking, I think we're about done for this episode. Thank you again for joining us. We have a great year planned. Lots of great new film coming out this month. We have Silberas starting to make their way to North America. I know James and I and a few other people.
Yeah, I backed Silbera, and I've got a nice big little pack of film coming. I think I did the same thing Alex did and be like, ooh, film, click.
Yeah, pretty much.
What? Film?
Cosmo Photo had their Mono 100. We'll be talking about that next episode. We also have plans in the work for a Classic Camera Revival meet in the fall in lovely downtown Galt or Cambridge.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I've been meaning to go there. They've got some beautiful waterways.
That'll probably be some point in either early September or middle of October, depending on weather. So keep an eye out on Facebook for that, probably in early August, late June. Well, that's it for me. My name's Alex Laux.
This is John Meadows. I like Rodinal 1 to plus 100. People say I'm compensating.
I'm Bill Smith, and yes, Mike is just bushy.
All right, let's pull this off now.
And that was Trevor Black.
I'm James Lee. If you're going to push your film, push it in the bush.
Bravo, James. You said you'd come up with fun, you did.
And to you, Donna.
Medic! Medic!
She's the color of someone in a dark room.
She's busy agitating.
Wow, we lost her. This is Mike Pataxi, and bye.